This is Jeff Kasmer from The End Line, and today I'm joined by Kaylin Carr.
Hey, Jeff. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Yeah, Kaylin, for folks who aren't familiar with your work, kind of what's your deal?
So I played in MLS for 8 years, Chicago Fire and Houston Dynamo, and then now I've transitioned to working in the digital media department here at MLS. Whole range of shows, whether it's Matchday Central, doing the studio analysis, Sky Sports News, and then also doing This Week in MLS with Susanna Collins. And then I guess the thing that we're here to talk a little bit more about today is around the Movement Show, which I hope people will check out, give us a look on YouTube. We've done 32 episodes now. They haven't all been released, but we've just gotten back from shooting in LA around Ramadan with LAFC players. And then in Seattle, talking about them going carbon neutral. And then in Minneapolis, sorry, I've been doing a lot of travel, so I'm catching up here on sleep, but looking at Pride. And then we have one out already this season in DC titled Chocolate City, looking at the history and legacy of African-American players in the district. So I hope hope you guys can check it out.
If you had to give kind of a thesis statement on the movement, what would it be?
We want to have, through this show, a little bit of a platform or an avenue to explore how race, how culture, how, identity or sexual preference, backgrounds might come together through soccer, and using soccer a little bit as a lens to understand, to create some deeper understandings of, you know, how do cultures collide in the US and Canada, or really around North America. We've even gone to Europe as well, and did an episode over in the UK. That one was a little bit more based on what's the conversation like between these two countries in soccer or through football or however you want to call it. So, we've been able to explore a little bit deeper. I think it is important to have this sort of deeper understanding between people through soccer, and soccer is just such a great lens for it. I think MLS is a great lens for it too, because if you look at our league overall, I believe we have over 59 different countries represented by players. And you know, we all know how much diversity there is within a country. So that's just sort of the entry point for a lot of this. So soccer is a world game. It's colliding here in the US in really interesting ways, growing so rapidly. That was kind of the thesis statement around the movement, but it's always changing. That's kind of the fun part of it too.
What's one of the most surprising stories you've told through the show so far?
I think the first one that pops up to mind was the one we did in Jackson, Mississippi. I think that was probably the first time we had left an MLS market for an episode of the movement. And it'd been one that I'd been wanting to do for a long time, but Jackson's not a common stopover in my soccer travels, or really anybody's. It's not a place you think of as a soccer town at all. And it presented some production challenges just as far as getting guys there. But I had gone there while I was a player for the Chicago Fire, and we would go there every preseason because Justin Mapp, my old teammate, is from Jackson. And we began going there in preseason, playing games there against Chivas USA. I believe we played a game against them. Rest in peace. and a bunch of Sporting Kansas City. At that time, I think Kansas City Wizards. So we had always gone there and played. We had great crowds show up to watch, I think mainly to support Justin. But also from just those little trips, you could see the beginnings of soccer really starting to take off there in Jackson, people having a real thirst for it. And then over time, I started to see players like Marlon Harrison and Marcus Epps emerge from Jackson all the way to MLS. And I just sort of saw their player bylines at the draft or heard about it. And I was like, what's up with this? This little Jackson is starting to bubble up a little bit, having some representation in MLS. Connected with the guys, it turns out that Marcus and Marlon had both been at those camps and little training sessions we'd gone to with the Fire growing up, had sort of idolized Justin Mapp. So we were able to get Marlon back and Justin. Weren't able to get Marcus just with his schedule, but meet their families, see how they grew up. And it was just a really unique story, just in the sense that you think of it as a football town, a basketball town. I think Marlon is actually cousins with LaMarcus Aldridge, who's, you know, NBA fame as well. But that was more the traditional path forward for professional sports. But you began to see, especially in inner city Jackson, central Jackson, there was this one club of young African-American players coming up through there that didn't really have a big background or base in playing, but became professionals, are professionals. Marlon's been called in with the men's national team. So when we look at how do we grow the sport in these sort of unique areas where maybe there isn't an MLS team, I thought Jackson was a really interesting model to look at through that lens.
When you look at a place like Jackson, the episode we were talking about with DC, there are these roots to the communities that go back decades, but they're growing and they're probably changing. You know, when you visit, do you see more of like, there's more, it's growing in the sense that there's more of the same people doing the thing now, or are they changing in the sense that it's more, but it's different mixes of people now?
What's interesting, it usually ties to just patterns of immigration. And a lot of cases, if you look at the story we did in DC, a lot of the early players on those Howard teams in the 70s were from the Caribbean. Justin Mapp also told me that a lot of his coaches were from the Caribbean in Jackson, or in suburban Jackson, and they taught him how to play. And I was like, wow, it makes a little bit more sense, because Justin plays, you know, white guy from the suburbs of Jackson, but he plays like a very creative sort of Caribbean style, where he likes to dribble guys one-on-one, step over, just has a little bit of a different rhythm to his game. And you can see that influence in a sense from the people that he was taught by. And then I think as time goes on, you begin to see this next generation of, you know, American born players, where now Justin Mapp is back in Mississippi coaching kids in the area. So yes, he's influenced by that history and immigration, but now is, you know, bringing his experience from playing in MLS for, you know, I think 12, 13, 14 years, 15 years, because he started young at 17, which is just remarkable to come from Jackson. He tells stories of playing against kids in football cleats, in club soccer, and then going to Bradenton and MLS. And then also seeing eventually, I'm sure, already the influence that Marlon and Marcus have had as far as the next crop of young players coming from their neighborhood coming up. So, yeah, it's interesting to see.
When you talk about who does and doesn't get to play a game, race, class, and privilege deserve to be part of the conversation. Do you see the movement as a social justice project?
I think so. I think in a sense, it's a really good lens to look through soccer to create a deeper understanding for society in general, and also to celebrate some of the progress that we've been able to make. So, you know, I would just go down to DC and to see the work that DC Scorers is doing, and DC United is a big part of that as well, which is really an interesting program where they're taking soccer and poetry and using that as a way to create sort of avenues for self-expression, whether they be spiritual, whether they be socio-emotional, or whether they're physical, and giving kids an opportunity, especially in areas in Black and Brown communities that haven't been able to have easy access to soccer. And I've seen that type of programming bubbling up a little bit more over the years. If you look at just the episodes we've done them in Harlem FC. We have one in Seattle coming out, hopefully pretty soon. We're working on editing that one right now. I'm on the board of Soccer Without Borders, which is a program that was started in Oakland, California by a good friend of mine that I grew up playing club soccer with, Ben Gucciardi, which is specifically targeting immigrant refugee populations in Oakland, but have programming all over the world now. So I think it's really inspiring for me to see kind of people going out there and rolling up their sleeves, getting the work done. I try to pop in and just help shine a light as much as I can. But there's a lot of people that are really doing it every day. And I think that's definitely always been a part of the show, but I feel like it's becoming a more fundamental part of seeing how the growth is, because you can't just look at MLS and say, wow, there's new expansion teams, there's new the growth of the league is incredible without looking at what undergirds it or what might influence it as time goes on. So to see that next generation, especially of former MLS players or MLS clubs going into their communities doing positive work has been really cool.
When you talk about players and former players, I can't help thinking about how over the past few years, like athletes in general have learned that you can go from being a starting quarterback in the Super Bowl to out of a job if you talk too loudly about politics. Is the modern player scared to talk about their views?
I don't think so, actually. I think the modern player actually is that's becoming more of a fundamental part of their existence as a player and their platform. If you look across sports, whether it's LeBron James, I mean, that's the first name that pops up to me because I just can't escape from the fact of, you know, this is the probably the most famous, I don't know, because Messi and Cristiano, you know, there's some big ones in world football, but here in the U.S., I feel like LeBron has the biggest voice in Canada as far as a platform, and the way he uses his to speak about issues that he cares about, I think is really tremendous. Colin Kaepernick, of course, as well as up there, Megan Rapinoe on the women's side is, you know, hopefully going to go on and win the World Cup, but just to be out as LGBTQ and to be outspoken about it has made her a figure that will transcend her impact beyond sport. And I think you're starting to see that more and more in MLS as well, too, with players that are willing to speak up on behalf of their community or the issues that they care about, whether that's via their own social media channels, which has become a huge avenue for players that didn't really even exist in my playing career as much or to the same degree as far as the platform where I use social media, but not really to talk about issues that I really cared about. It's more about, I don't know, having some fun online with fans or maybe hearing what other people were saying about me after a match. But that's kind of flipped a switch now where players are being able to use them as tools to speak about issues that affect them and issues they really care about.
It has to make those media managers and media contacts at teams so nervous, right? When you have a team full of people like speaking their mind, right? It's like, they could say anything. It's like, yeah, they're probably going to say something smart though.
I hope not. I hope it. I mean, I understand that in some ways their job is to protect their players, but it's also to promote them and to give them a voice. And I feel proud that, you know, the show that I'm involved in, The Movement, has been a vehicle for players to be able to speak for themselves and to ask the questions that they might not be asked all the time. And I think it's starting to grow a little bit more. I've been able to take part in producing a Black History Month roundtable that's happening. My colleague Susanna Collins moderated a women in soccer panel last year, which I would highly recommend people to go watch. It was about 20 minutes, but I just wanted it to like keep going and keep going because there's just so much to say. And I just think the more we can take part in these conversations in real ways, the more I think it will just spark more conversation for, you know, whether it's fans or on podcasts or other places. So I'm really seeing that changing, especially over the last 3 years, which isn't a long time since I've worked at MLS in the digital media department.
It's interesting, like mentioning Susanna, right? Where 6 months ago, you would be hard pressed to find soccer podcasts, localized or national, that had any women involved. And now she's got her own podcast with just two women. And I was listening to it in the car the other day, and it's just like, this is so cool. Like, I can't believe I'm listening to a soccer podcast that is only women. It's neat.
I mean, it's a shame that that's even a consideration, but it is stark because especially, I wouldn't know what the numbers are, but I would venture to guess that the podcasting space in particular seems, especially around sports, is kind of the model has always been men sitting in a room and usually white men. So the idea that you know, there's women's podcasts, or I've been following other podcasts, there's a soccer podcast, I think in Atlanta or I think DC called For the Culture, which I've been listening to also, which is a little bit more around, I think it's a couple black people, black guys, black women, who are involved in talking about soccer. And from that perspective, and I just think, you know, the Cooligans here in New York, you know, I think Dominican and Cuban heritage, and just the more that we can get representation at all levels of media is going to be really positive. So it's cool to see that happening, especially around the sort of ecosystem of MLS.
Yeah. MLS has made a pretty big show this month of embracing pride and pride kits, declaring soccer for all month. But declaring the month, saying the slogan, is like a long way from actually making soccer for all. What do you think needs to happen for MLS to feel like it's embracing like all Americans?
Well, I think, you know, these months people talk, go back and forth. Is it a good thing to do to celebrate, you know, Black History Month or Pride Month? And to me, the answer is always yes. I think it's important to recognize these communities, especially the ones that maybe have been left a little bit outside and haven't been able to have easy access or haven't always been welcomed as a part of the soccer community, and to sort of say actively like, no, you belong here and this is a place for you. And the issue is that it can't just stop there. It's not just about that month. It's about trying to create this as a year long and sort of always ongoing, omnipresent sort of value system. And I know diversity and inclusion, I mean, it's fundamental to my background, just as being a person of color. My dad is Aboriginal Australian. And as well as just the people that I've played with in locker rooms across the country, from, you know, Texas, where we had guys from the South who had, you know, came from sort of, well, I guess non-traditional soccer backgrounds, but fell in love with the game. And then you have people come from places like Ghana who just grew up as it's the only thing that was really available to them as far as anything outside of school as well. And Latin players learning different languages, races, religions, you know, everything really. So it's been fundamental to my experience in MLS. And I think the work that I'm doing now, I think, tries to reflect some of that experience from being in those locker rooms and taking them outside into conversations so people can understand that, like, hey, these conversations are happening in locker rooms. And it's something that I think is, I know it's happening in the fan bases as well, because I go around and travel and I see diversity amongst the fan bases. And I'd like to continue to see that, you know, grow and change. And I'm seeing different supporter groups pop up and representing different communities now. That's a really positive side.
The interesting challenge to me, I think we talk about in my work, like the differences between diversity and inclusion, right? And like diversity being about identity and who we are, and inclusion being about how we think and how we act. Yeah. And it is, I think it's positive for soccer that diversity is there in the player pool, right? We'll get into some other pieces of that in a minute. It's there sometimes in the fan base, but the inclusion is a much higher level where things, it's not just like, oh, the English players are in this corner of the locker room, the African players are in this corner of the locker room, right? The Central American players over here, but to find a way for things to get really tied together where it's like mutual participation, not just like indifference, right, or lack of discrimination, but to say like, let's honor each other, let's be excited about each other. And you know, when we talk about these months, as you said, like I think sometimes people can feel like, oh, every month is some month, you know. And it's like, yeah, man, it's like, can you imagine, these people are here all the time every month, it's crazy, you know. It's like, yeah, we should, like, what is the harm in recognizing and celebrating like people that we care about?
Well, I'll tell you what, on the field, there's no choice but to have inclusion if you want to be a successful team. I mean, there's no you sitting on one side of the locker room and someone else, like, you're on the pitch and you have to find a way to make it work amongst each other. So I think in some ways, the locker room and what happens on the field, the collaboration, the respect, the brotherhood, the family aspect. People say that this is a family, it's a cliche, but I spent more time with people in locker rooms than my family at times, and those are for guys that have kids and wives and or husbands or whatever. And so in some ways, I think the locker room and the pitch itself can be a good model for society at large.
We know from social science that visual representation, seeing people like me, is key, is like a key factor in getting young people excited about a potential life path. You mentioned it a little bit with those like people in Jackson, Mississippi. Like, how frequently do you, when you're talking to communities, like, does it matter that a player looks like them, or is it enough for them to be from where they're from?
Yeah, it is a powerful thing to be seen and to feel seen and to see yourself in others. I see that. I know that from my experience growing up, where even just seeing people of color playing for the U.S. men's national team, seeing Kobe Jones play look different than maybe some of the other players on the team, with his dreads going, the way he expressed himself was inspiring to me, even though I'm not African-American, but just a person of color seeing him out there. I think that's why it's so important that we celebrate the women's national team now and cover them fully to the measure that they have deserved for a long time and haven't always gotten, because it is important for not just young girls, but young boys to be able to watch, to grow up and see the U.S. winning the World Cup potentially, or seeing that level of excellence where you can see yourself in somebody, even if it doesn't look exactly like you or have the same background, but is either from the same place or maybe share some of the same values that you have. So, but I do think it is especially important for communities of color or people from different backgrounds that have been historically oppressed or left outside, because when you see somebody, when you're told in a lot of different ways in society that this isn't for you, or you're not as good as other people, or that something is holding you back or inherently different about you, and then you see somebody who shares those same traits that you may have been told or felt, and you see them succeeding at the highest level or just participating at the highest level, whether that kid goes on to be to do the same or not is just an edifying experience for people. So I think that's really powerful.
Earlier this season, Matt Doyle was talking on a podcast about the theory or kind of observations that in years past, kids on homegrown contracts, I should say young people on homegrown contracts, didn't always get a fair run out, that they would get a start or two or three, and if they weren't performing, they might be on the bench, whereas players coming from overseas would get 6 or 8 or 10 games to like find their way and then perform well. Do you think that happens with underrepresented players more? If I am a player who doesn't look like the rest of my team, is my leash shorter?
I don't think so, but I think the reason why is I think our teams are very diverse to begin with. So I think the chances that you walk into a locker room and someone looks like you are usually pretty high. So I think there has been a cultural change as far as the emphasis of playing young players, for sure. And that has been really transformational for MLS. When I played in MLS, there were no academies. There were no homegrown players. There's some developmental players that were, often local guys or from the area because they could sort of afford to live there and maybe play for not a lot of money. But now it's really changed. I mean, even the attitude towards coming in when I was a rookie was like, hey, rookie, go carry the goals. You got to earn your stripes. If you get some playing time, good for you. But there was surely no pressure to play me as a young player. I would sort of dream of that type of environment. And it's a positive one. And I think teams are starting to see that bear fruit, where you see the Alphonso Davies, the Tyler Adams, Paxton Pomacall, a lot of these young players that are coming through systems, getting identified young, but then actually having pressure on the manager or from the fan base to play them. You know, and Matt Doyle does a huge part in doing that. I wish I had that Doyle hype. I remember being a rookie and I scored 5 goals in the Open Cup with Chicago Fire in 2006, and we went to go play in the final against the Galaxy. And there was questions about whether I was going to start in the final or not. I'd scored 2 goals in the semi against DC United. But like now I know that I would have, you know, Matt Doyle and myself and the whole crew would have been there doing a full 30-minute or an hour live pregame show. It would have been a topic of discussion whether I started or not. I didn't start. I didn't end up even playing in the final. We won the final. Still a super proud moment for me, and won an Open Cup. I have a ring for it. Proud of that forever. But I do think about that sometimes as far as the media pressure and just the cultural shift as far as valuing young players, wanting to play them, fans wanting to see them play, how that could have changed the trajectory of I guess that day for me. But I think it's a positive for the career of young American players of all backgrounds now.
I'm curious to see, you know, Colorado here has signed several academy products in the last year or so, and there's so much excitement around this guy's 17, this guy's 18, this guy's 16. I feel like there's a little bit of missing follow-up conversation, which is like, is he a 16-year-old phenom, or is it like, you're just 16? You know, like you might still just be a guy, a kid, whatever. Like it's almost like we've gotten so into the idea of young players that it's like anyone who's young and plays soccer, let's sign them. Does it feel that way? Like, do you think that hype is too big, or is it like, are these guys actually going to find traction?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's always a balance, and I don't think it's a new phenomenon to hype young players. If you date back, even looking throughout U.S. soccer history, it's always been, and not just in soccer, just in sports in general and across the world, there's just this excitement of, wow, this person could come along and be something special, and not all of them turn into LeBron James or Landon Donovan or DeMarcus Beasley the way they go on and live and really defy expectations in a lot of those cases. It's super rare because there's so many variables that take place between 16 and 18 and 18 and 21 and 21 and 24. But I just know from my experience, I think just getting in a high performance environment at a younger age is a positive. I had to sort of manufacture those experiences growing up in the Bay Area because I didn't have necessarily, no disrespect to my clubs that I played for there, but we didn't really have like a really positive professional environment. I was coached predominantly through my youth by people's dads or other professional players that were in the area that sort of just took it upon themselves to kind of take me under their wing, do individual sessions, or I would go play pickup soccer with the old Greek guys down at Kleeberger Field in Berkeley, and they'd kick me and I'd come right back up. And that's kind of how I had to really learn the game, as opposed to being in this structured environment. Now, I do think there is a challenge. I was talking to John Thorrington, a former teammate of mine at LAFC, who's now the LAFC executive vice president and running the team operations there, about trying to make these academy kids understand what a great opportunity and giving them all of the best facilities and performance training, everything, coaching, and the ideas that those guys, especially at LAFC, have are incredible. I mean, just to watch them train or be close to Bob Bradley is tremendous. But how do you still dangle that carrot to make sure that, hey, you haven't made it? You know, there's still a long way to go. And I think that starts with how you talk to kids, the cultural values of the club, where you can encourage them and push them forward, but also understand that there's a big step to try and make it to the first team. And then once you're on the first team, to being a professional.
Don't you feel like if you had Bob Bradley as like your life coach, like if Bob Bradley followed you around and just coached you through life, like your ceiling would be limitless?
I would definitely be more on top of my game, I feel like, because I just was in LA doing an interview with Bob for an upcoming movement episode we're doing around the players there and some of the staff that are observing Ramadan. I think that will be a really interesting movement episode where I just learned a lot about it. But sitting down to talk to Bob, I mean, he's a serious dude. Like, he is a very serious guy. He's meticulous in his preparation. Being able to watch him train this team and to see some of the behind the scenes workings of how just incredible that midfield is working, and the way he's been able to set that team up to really be one of the best MLS teams we've seen in a long time. It's pretty incredible to see. But yeah, I have a ton of respect for Bob, and the fact that I played for the Chicago Fire, I was able to be influenced by so many people that kind of came from the Bob tree, whether that was Dave Sarek and Dennis Hamlett, Chris Armas, Jim Curtin. I mean, they're all coaches now across the league. So that should tell you something as far as the type of impact that he's had on U.S. soccer and across MLS.
I wanted to ask you, if you look at the MLS yearly coaches photo, it's all male. It's a pretty tight age range and very light complexion. White men in the U.S. make up 31% of the population, but make up about 84% of MLS coaches. There are zero African-American coaches, zero Asian-American coaches. Does coaching representation matter?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I was fortunate enough to play for Dennis Hamlett in Chicago, who is the first Black head coach in MLS. And I think a lot about the legacy that Dennis has in MLS as a player. Now he is in a position of power, of course, as the sporting director. And I think in general, in some ways, I felt like I wanted Dennis to succeed because he was a person of color and because he was the first Black head coach, and he did succeed. He had a very successful run, and he still has. He's still finding great success. But yeah, we need more. We need more. I think it's obvious whether you're just looking at the photos involved of the coaches. And I think it needs to happen. It's a conversation that if you talk to people around, or we've been able to talk about it a little bit, the Black History Month roundtables that we've hosted at MLS, it has been a topic of conversation amongst the players and on both the men's and women's side of the game. So it's I think it's something that is a big question, and one that needs to be asked and talked about more. And try and find more opportunities, not just on the playing side, but how do you get more Black technical directors, sporting directors, coaches, presidents within the front office and to the higher levels as far as ownership and executives as well.
I got my fingers crossed that I'm going to be seeing a lot of Robin Fraser around here in Colorado. We'll see what happens in the next couple of weeks.
Well, Dennis is a Colorado, you know, man himself, but I know he's in a great position here with the Red Bulls. But yeah, I mean, Robin would be an excellent choice. I've played against him and seen him as a manager, and always had a ton of respect for him. It's just a matter of when and where is that right opportunity.
Last question for you. Say I'm a fan of soccer and I want to see progress. Like I want to see this like inclusive community build. What can I as an individual do to help make that happen?
That's a good question. I was just talking to Colin Martin actually in Minneapolis recently.
I thought that might be why you were in Minneapolis.
Yeah. We're doing an episode there around their Pride match and just Colin's story in general and Minneapolis and St. Paul as a really welcoming, inclusive place, especially with a real history with the LGBTQ community. And I asked him like, hey, how can I be a good ally? How can people be a good ally for this, for what LGBTQ people deal with maybe in soccer or outside in society? He just told me to the best thing you can do is to just like listen to people, listen to them, support them. It's always a fine line because you don't want to take a step too far forward and speak on behalf of anybody else. But I think about just kind of creating safe spaces for people, pushing people forward when you have an opportunity to, even as just far as saying, hey, if there's an opportunity for someone else to take the lead, maybe I'll take a step back. And I've tried to find opportunities to do that in my own personal life or in the programs that we do. But I think it's just about kind of having a conversation. I think people are more open to talking about these tougher topics than you might expect. and sharing some of their experience, whether it's as a person of color, a woman, whatever background they might have, and saying, hey, this is something that you might not even know that I've been through or that I've dealt with. And just even creating that sense of understanding is a good, good starting point. But then it has to go past there, because it has to also lead to like real genuine action. And there's a lot of ways to do that, from looking at things from a structural level to just getting involved in your neighborhood or your community, wherever you are, or outside it, taking a step outside it. That's also a good first step. This has been something I've been thinking about for a while, but and I haven't been able to really express it through the show as of yet. But I just have this idea that a lot of times, especially around soccer conversations, we tend to frame the conversation around what could the soccer benefit be for the U.S. or MLS on either men or women's soccer, and just what it could mean for the soccer benefit. And I just think we have to start getting a little bit away from that, just from looking at it as, oh, well, what if we had more Black guys playing on the men's national team or the women's national team? Or what if we had more underrepresented minorities playing in MLS? And it's like, to me, that's kind of missing the point a little bit, because we should just be able to allow people to play soccer. And it just, the sport itself gives people such a huge positive life force, whether that's from understanding and meeting people from different backgrounds the way I was lucky to in my career, or whether it's physical fitness, self-belief or self-confidence. There's innumerable ways to do it. So when we look at like creating access and opportunity, especially around underrepresented groups, it's important to not just look at it from the sort of transactional, this is what we get from this, and look at it more as like, this is something that is like the right thing to do and could really make a genuine impact in a lot of people's lives.
I think that's the right place for us to wrap it up. Thanks, Kaylin, for your time.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much for having me.